Tonight, our special guest is physicist Russell Targ, a pioneer in remote viewing, parapsychology, physics, laser physics. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Tonight, we're going to talk about a man, the story of a man, Russell Targ, a physicist, author who's been a pioneer in the development of the laser and laser applications, co-founder of the Stanford Research Institute's investigation into psychic abilities in the 70s and 1980s, kind of the real X-Files. He's a co-author of 7 books dealing with the scientific investigation of scientific abilities and transforming of consciousness, most recently, The End of Suffering, A Guide to Fearless Living. His latest, of course, an autobiography called Do You See What I See? Here he is, Russell Targ. Russell, welcome to the show, my friend. How are you?
Good evening. I'm very happy to be with you.
You know, you have touched so many lives, not only in your career, but on this program over the years that you've been on it. And I wanted to thank you on behalf of just everybody associated with Coast to Coast for what you've brought to all of us over the years.
Well, it's always very nice to have a chance to carry the message that people have psychic abilities. It's not weird. It's not hard to do. And encourage people to get in touch with a part of themselves that's psychic. You don't have to eat porridge at the feet of your guru or give away all your money. So my job, in a certain sense, is to give people permission to make use of their abilities rather than to teach them anything.
You know, the more I got into your career over the years, Russell, the more I began to realize how remarkable you are. In one respect, you're a motorcyclist and you're legally blind. How do you do this?
That's right. When I was working a title with my publisher on the book that we all liked, Do You See What I See? But they said, you need something more. So we call it Memoirs of a Blind Biker. And that's true. I have been legally blind since I was a child, much like the governor of New York State. So I now have somebody else out there who's legally blind but functioning. David Patterson is the new governor of New York. And legally blind person does not mean that he walks with a cane. It means that his vision is less than 2200, which is to say, I see at 20 feet what you can see at 200 feet. The consequence of that is that in a classroom, I'm not able to see the blackboards. And if I'm looking at paintings with my artist wife, I have to be 2 feet from them and she can be 20 feet from them. But we both like impressionist art. It's just that the world looks at a pretty impressionist way to me all along. So with regard to riding a motorcycle, I can't read license plates, but I can see big things like cars and trucks. And my task was just to persuade the Motor Vehicle Bureau that they should give me a driving license for a motorcycle, even though I couldn't read their silly chart.
How did you pull that off? Test?
Well, you remember Humpty Dumpty. Humpty Dumpty said that when I use a word, it means just what I want it to mean, neither more nor less. So I went to my ophthalmologist at Kaiser Hospital and told them, if you can give me a letter saying that it's safe to drive, then the motor vehicle people will let me do that. And the physician was very concerned. He said, after all, you can't see anything past the big E. I said, that's all right. If you'll just say my vision has not gotten worse since you've known me, which is true.
Right.
I said, yes, I can say that. And if you can say that I should be allowed to drive anything that I can drive safely, that'll do. He said, you can drive anything you can drive safely. That's okay. I can sign that. So that made the doctor happy. That satisfied the DMV. I showed up with this vacuous letter that didn't mean a damn thing. And they said, well, here you go. You can drive your tiny motorcycle. And year by year, I increased the size from a tiny 50C Mobilette that ran against the tire of the bike up to what I have recently, the 250C Honda Nighthawk.
Uh-huh. The Nighthawk, which is what I call myself on the air sometimes.
That's right. So it's the idea that nothing has to be true, things just have to seem true.
The the handicap. Should I even call it a handicap, your vision? Is that accurate? Is that fair?
Certainly.
Maybe not. Okay.
I was always concerned about being poor as I grew up. I grew up in New York City in the 50s. There were lots of poor people pushing push carts. And I was aware that there were many things that I couldn't do. No matter how capable I was, I could never be a shortstop, even though I loved baseball. I couldn't be a carpenter or a pilot or anything. I couldn't even be a checker in a grocery store. So I was really limited in what I could do. So I worked very hard as a student because I knew that I could do certain things. I could be a scientist. You don't have to see very well to do that. But I was quite aware that there were limitations, and although I loved music, I had no talent. So that was no matter how much I practiced the piano, I was never going to get to Carnegie Hall, because in addition to practice, it requires talent. So I was handicapped. I was also worried that I'd never get married, because I had the idea that we live in a car society, and if you can't drive, how would you ever get a partner? How would you ever get a girlfriend?
Go on a date and things like that.
That's right.
Well, you pulled it off, let me tell you.
I managed to do that. I fooled him for all these years.
Did this condition help you in the remote viewing aspects of your career?
I have an idea that it probably did, because as I started out as a young person doing magic, and the whole idea is that we're questioning reality. Things are not what they seem to be. And as a young kid, I had the run of New York City. I could take the subways to 42nd Street. I lived in Greenwich Village. I could watch the magic shows and Hubert's Flea Circus back when they actually... Now, you may not realize this, but there were flea circuses in the basement of the shooting galleries on 42nd Street. And a flea circus has little fleas with parasols and other fleas pulling carriages, and they hand you a large magnifying glass so you can actually see the fleas doing this. So flea circuses actually exist.
This is for real?
Yes.
Okay.
And there was also a magician there, and I could stand as a 12-year-old or 11-year-old, stand right next to him and watch him doing tricks. And then I could go upstairs to the various office buildings, to the professional magic stores, and talk to magicians, buy books, and buy magic tricks. So I became a pretty proficient teenage magician from just reading books and talking to people and practicing. And the experience that I had is that occasionally I'd be standing on the stage doing some mental magic trick, pretending to read somebody's mind in the audience, and I would get more information than I had from cheating and reading their card in advance.
Right.
I would know that there's somebody there looking for her dog. But after I said, is there a woman in the audience who's looking for a dog? Someone would stand up and say, yes, where is Fido? And I, of course, wouldn't know that. But I would sometimes be able to describe what her house looked like and the stairs and the bedroom and the patchwork quilt and the tree in the front yard. And of course, that was totally amazing to people, because that's genuine mind reading. And every magician, even the ones who hate ESP, will admit that they sometimes, Dunninger would agree with that, or Melvin Christopher. They didn't like psychic stuff, but they agreed that it did happen from time to time. They would get psychic information coming to them. Now, as a visually handicapped person, I am very comfortable at the moment's notice to sit and close my eyes and just visualize things. So I have the idea that my poor vision gave me a push in the direction of doing psychic stuff.
I would think it gave you not a better ability than most, but a better insight, I think, into basically what we were going to be talking about tonight, and that is, of course, ESP, remote viewing, and you, the story of Russell Targ. Do you keep in touch with Ingo anymore? How's he doing?
Oh, I see Ingo whenever I come to New York. He's doing pretty well. he doesn't get a lot of exercise. He's sort of living in his loft building, still painting. I'm always very happy to see him. Very entertaining, charming fellow. He's a good friend and was a good teacher. It was Ingo Swann who taught us all how to do remote viewing. Ingo, who is a prodigious psychic from childhood, Ingo taught Hal Puthoff and me how to do remote viewing at Stanford Research Institute. Hal and I then taught six men from Army Intelligence in the middle 1970s. We chose six guys from Army Intelligence Command, and we taught them what we knew about the practice of remote viewing. They went back to Fort Meade and set up a remote viewing capability there, so they weren't just dependent on people in California, which made them nervous. So they had an independent remote viewing activity there for 20 years, and they taught dozens and dozens of people. So if anyone is skeptical about remote viewing at this point, you could go to the internet and simply look up remote viewing in quotation marks, and there's more than a million sites dealing with remote viewing, which is quite astonishing. And the reason there's so many sites is that remote viewing is very easy to do. So people see remote viewing, they say, that's interesting, can you show me how to do it? I'll show someone how to do it. And they say, that's amazing, and they immediately start teaching it. So there's hundreds and hundreds of people teaching remote viewing. And in my little book, You See What I See, I give a kind of manual to show people how to do remote viewing as we did at SRI. So it's a kind of guidebook, how to get in touch with your psychic self. And when I travel abroad, which I do frequently, I do workshops. And even if it's in a foreign language that I don't speak, I can swiftly show people how to quiet their mind and describe things that I've hidden from them or will show them in a little while. So we live in a world where we have this additional ability. It's not a magic trick. It's a capability that we were born with. In the Buddhist literature, they talk about psychic abilities for the past 2,500 years. Buddhist in the year 1800 has a whole manual called Self-Realization Through Seeing with Naked Awareness. We can talk about that later.
Sure.
Where he invites you to move from your present difficult, anguish situation called conditioned awareness to freedom, naked awareness, where you experience the universe, where you have limitless awareness, and that's part of your spiritual development. He's not interested in making you psychic. He's interested in freeing you from all the different things that cause you judgment, grief, and anxiety. And you do that by moving into the spacious realm. And that was already part of the most pristine Buddhist teachings 1,200 years ago.
It's an incredible tool that all of us possess. Not all of us understand how to use it yet, though, Russell. Why is that?
Oh, it's forbidden. Our society says that psychic ability is crazy, it doesn't exist, it's a sign of mental illness, because it's seen to be contrary to modern physics. Now, since I've been doing this, modern physics has finally caught up with psychic ability. So that if I were back in graduate school at Columbia, I would be studying non-locality, which is, well, non-locality was first spoken about in the 1930s, but in the 1970s, it was shown to be true. Non-locality shows that things that are separate from one another in ordinary physical sense are actually connected. So there's a connection in time and space which is beyond what you would ordinarily think. And this is a hot topic, probably the most interesting thing in modern physics. So modern physics has finally caught up with psychic abilities and given us permission to make use of this ability we all have. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, it sure is. Ingo knew my late aunt, Dr. Shafika Karegula. I'm wondering, did you ever meet her during her time?
Yes, I did. She wrote this wonderful book. I actually have a connection with Shefika Karagula. She wrote this great book, Breakthrough to Creativity.
Yep.
And that was all about Dora Kunz, who is head of the Theosophical Society in New York City. And when I was a 20-year-old, I was very involved in the Theosophical Society in New York. So I knew Dora Kunz, who was a profoundly psychic woman. I had all sorts of interesting experiences with her. But her big claim to fame, Dora Kunz was, is that she had healing and diagnostic abilities. But she couldn't do that in the hospital because people thought that anything psychic was crazy. So she worked with two physicians and nurses that she taught how to do this. Dolores Krieger was her particular girlfriend, and they invented what's called therapeutic touch.
Mm-hmm.
And Dolores Krieger taught Janet Quinn, who brought therapeutic touch to thousands and thousands of hospitals. So therapeutic touch came out of the work of Dora Kunz, which is in your great aunt's book, Breakthrough to Creativity.
Yep.
And I knew all of those people. I knew Dolores Krieger and Dora Kunz quite well. And Janet Quinn is the one who is a very attractive, energetic person who's going around now teaching. She's a PhD in nursing and is teaching all of these people how to do therapeutic touch, which is actually therapeutic non-touch. It's healing. We should say that it's a healing protocol where you hold your hands near the person and send energy from yourself to the person. And the result is there's all sorts of healing taking place. So it's not laying out of hands, because doctors don't like nurses to touch their patients. So it was Janet Quinn who first figured out that you don't actually have to touch them. But this all came from Breakthrough to Creativity, which is a wonderful book written in the 60s by Shefika Karagula.
What a tragic death, Russell, for her. We've always wondered truly what the circumstances were behind it. Always told that a radio fell into a bathtub and she was taking a bath.
Yeah, I had heard that story.
Strange.
But Dora Kunz, who she taught, was the president of the Theosophical Society in New York, and I knew her quite well, and she was really a prodigious psychic woman. She could do all sorts of visual and psychokinetic things. She was really a dynamite, and she was head of that organization into her 90s.
That is truly amazing. Russell, what we're going to talk about tonight, of course, is you. Do you see what I see in this incredible work that you've done throughout the years, including for the CIA? And I want to get into that. And also, I find out that you are the brother-in-law to the late Bobby Fischer. Who,
yes, indeed.
He had what kind of an incredible mind did he have, Russell? Let's talk a little bit about that when we come back as well. Russell's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's espresearch.com. And in all my history of interviewing people associated with this subject, and we've talked to some heavy hitters, Russell Targ and Ingo Swann stand out amongst the rest. And we'll be back with the life story of Russell Targ in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got Russell Targ tonight. Do you see what I see? He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Russell, in writing the autobiography, Do You See What I See? The Memoirs of a Blind Biker, what theme were you looking for primarily? Just to write about your life, or was there a message here?
I was trying to encourage people to get in touch with the part of themselves, the psychic. As we all have the psychic ability, but it's basically forbidden in this society. We all hearken back to witch burnings and smell of burning flesh from Salem, and that's quite scary to people. And psychic ability is sort of forbidden in this society, And we've now been doing this for 30 years. We had a program at Stanford Research Institute, which was well supported by the government, the CIA and NASA, Defense Intelligence Agency. So we had a program that ran from 1972 to 1995, so a 25-year program doing operational psychic stuff for the government. And the people who took part in the research with us learned to get in touch with their psychic abilities and have gone on to make use of that in their lives. So they just had additional awareness of an ability they've already had. So rather than teaching people to be psychic, my job is to give them permission to make use of this ability. And in writing this book, I describe how I happen to get into such an unusual thing, starting out with being a teenage magician on the stage in New York. And then probably because of my bad vision, I got interested in lasers and optics. So I was a pioneer in the development of the laser. I was working on lasers before there were any lasers. So I spent almost two decades doing optics and laser research and development. And then I was willing to bet my career that I could help people get in touch with their psychic selves, because I'd been doing magic all along through this period as a amateur slash professional magician. And it was clear to me that there was a lot of genuine psychic perception leaking through the tricks that I would do. I was able to supplement my tricks with whatever ESP came my way. Uri Geller probably does it the other way. Uri Geller is the famous Israeli mentalist who is able to, he claims that he has a lot of psychic ability, of which he has some, so he supplements his trickery with whatever ESP comes his way. And what we were encouraging the government people to do is to get in touch with their own psychic ability and develop that. So I want to be clear that Geller does have some amount of psychic ability, not as great as the great people we work with, like Pat Price and Ingo Swann and Joe McMonagall, but certainly more than the average bear. So Geller obviously has a lot of psychic ability, just not as much as he claimed, in my opinion.
Do you think he can bend spoons by simply touching them with his energy?
Well, I know that's very controversial, but and I wrote in, we published an article in Nature magazine in about the mid-1970s, saying that we didn't see any spoon bending from Geller, which indeed we did not. But about 10 years later, I took part in a spoon bending party, which is kind of evening activity that you might find happening in California. And my writing partner, Jane Catra, with whom I've written a number of books, just sat quietly, quite bored with the whole thing, and the bowl of a teaspoon just rolled up like a little snail shell in her hand. The bowl rolled up. So we found that very amazing. And then I was inspired. So the following month, we went to another one of these things, and I was able to bend a 3/8-inch diameter steel rod in my own, holding it carefully in my fingertips.
No trickery, right?
So it's one of these things, I hate to admit it, but some amount of Geller's metal bending, I'm confident is correct. So after decrying him for a decade, I have to come back and admit that some part of that, he's a magician. So obviously he will deceive you in whatever way you let him deceive you. But I'm now quite convinced that some amount of the metal bending is genuine.
Ah, okay. You know, he's been on the program a couple times, Russell, and he has literally, based on responses I've gotten, started broken watches and clocks, some of which, again, based on my responses, have started without batteries, for example. I mean, it's very strange, very strange.
Well, the world definitely has things going on that we don't understand. When I saw Jane just holding, she was quite bored with the whole thing. She's a spiritual healer, and she was just waiting for us to clean up, and she was sort of meditating with this teaspoon clutched in her hand, and suddenly she screamed as it began to wiggle like a worm in her hand, and we looked at it, and the whole bowl, not the handle, the whole stainless steel bowl had just rolled up.
That's incredible.
And we thought it was very incredible.
You know, Edgar Mitchell is a true fan of Uri Geller as well, so maybe there is that combination of his abilities, his mix and match there.
I think so. Edgar Mitchell supported our initial work at SRI. And what we found at SRI is that with encouragement, we worked with six Army officers during the Cold War.
Was Paul Smith part of your group?
I worked with Paul Smith. Paul Smith is a fine fellow.
Yeah, I like him.
And he is a major when he retired, and he ran the Fort Meade group. So the Army hated the idea that all the ESP lived in California. So we wound up teaching a bunch of Army officers how to do remote viewing, and Paul Smith was part of that Fort Meade operation.
How about David Morehouse?
Well, Morehouse came in at the end of that, and it's unclear what Morehouse actually knew how to do.
Ed Daines?
I can't comment. Similarly, Ed Daines. I mean,
okay.
Ed Daines makes a whole lot of claims for, he claims prodigious remote viewing. Remote viewing does exist. It is available. He claims to be infallible, but I've never seen him do anything correct. That is, he makes lots and lots and lots of predictions and claims for what's going to happen, and I have found him to be unfailingly incorrect.
Was he part of the group? Or
he was not part of our group.
He was not part of your group. Okay. All right. It's good to know that. Russell, tell us a little bit about the origination of the Stanford Research Institute with you, with Ingo. How did that start?
Hal was a physicist from Stanford, Hal Puthoff.
Okay.
So in the beginning, there was Hal Puthoff. And he was doing some experiments with Ingo Swann, this famous New York psychic who had worked at the American Society for Psychical Research. They had a tiny program, but no money. I had the idea. I was doing laser physics as a profession. And I was also involved in ESP research and magic. And I was invited to a conference on speculative technology that NASA was holding. And I gave a lecture at this conference at St. Simon's Island. And there I met Wernher von Braun and Fletcher, who was the head of NASA, and Arthur C. Clarke, and a number of other NASA luminaries. And I convinced them that psychic abilities, was James Fletcher, who was the director of NASA, I convinced them that psychic abilities really could work. I had an ESP teaching machine with me, and von Braun did quite well with this electronic ESP teaching machine. So I was there basically to pitch a program to get some money to teach astronauts how to get in touch with their spaceship psychically. As far-fetched as that might sound.
And were they receptive?
And they were receptive. They thought that. Von Braun said, basically what we learned from von Braun is that everybody has a psychic grandmother. So and I was only asking for $80,000 at the time.
No,
so
money.
Von Braun told Fletcher that they should give us some money. So I then came to SRI, where Hal was without any money, and I came with NASA support and a NASA contract monitor and Edgar Mitchell. So we were then legitimate. We had that money from NASA to do ESP research. So we were off and running. We just had to promise not to tell anybody.
And this is before the CIA got involved?
Yes.
Okay.
So that was 1972.
Okay.
CIA came along shortly thereafter with a classified part of the program. So we always had a classified part of the program where we were spying on the Russians and the Chinese and other people, and we couldn't talk about that. But our deal with the CIA was that if we could do useful work for the CIA, they would support our work if we promised not to mention their name. But we could publish the scientific findings in the journals, which is what we did.
And then eventually it became declassified, and we found out the CIA was involved. How serious, Russell, was the CIA with your work?
Oh, they were very serious. That is, once Hal and I, is basically two only children, Hal Puthoff and I, went to the CIA as scientists. Most of the other people doing ESP research sort of gave themselves to ESP and lived rather impoverished lives. Hal and I were physicists, and we felt that we should be well supported for our research, and persuaded the director of intelligence at CIA, who is John McMahon, that we could do serious stuff, and we proposed a demonstration of abilities working with Pat Price and Ingo Swann. We said that we will describe your favorite site, whatever it is. Will you then support us?
That only the CIA knew, probably.
That's
right.
Right.
Okay.
And one of the CIA people then came to SRI, gave us the geographical coordinates, and Pat Price gave a very accurate description of the inside and the outside of this place. And they said, that's as much information as we've ever had about it. And they supported our work, and we all kept our bargain. They continued to support us. We continue to give information to them about downed airplanes and Chinese weapons tests and hostages and so forth, and we can talk about that. And, of course, we didn't publicize any of that. That was a secret program. But they did allow us to publish our findings in the proceedings of the Institute of Electrical Engineers and in Nature magazine. So CIA treated us well. They paid us well. Hal and I had a good time for a decade. We worked with Ingo Swann, Pat Price, and then started an Army program with the prodigious Joe McMonagle,
yes,
who is still doing remote viewing. So we saw quite a number of people who could close their eyes and describe with great accuracy what's happening anywhere on the planet.
Joe's a good guy. Can you tell us what that original CIA target was for that test that got you the deal with him?
That's a place called Semipalatinsk in Soviet Siberia. And what Ingo and Pat both described was a building with a giant crane rolling back and forth over the building with a huge gantry crane. And inside the building, they were constructing a big steel sphere out of gores, sort of slices that they were putting together. And they were trying to build this giant sphere as a containment vessel for a particle beam weapon to shoot down satellites that were taking pictures of their thing.
Oh, my God. Back in the 70s? They were working on that kind of technology?
So they had a particle beam weapon, possibly driven by an atomic explosion inside the sphere. And we totally described that. Unfortunately, Price died the following year. But 2 years later, we got complete feedback, and he described it perfectly, and our work was supported for the next 20 years.
Russell, and I have to believe that if the Soviets were close to that 30 years ago plus, they must have something, or somebody's got that kind of technology today, don't you think?
I wouldn't be surprised. Well, there's a lot of interest in so-called particle beam weapons. They may have been overtaken now with high-power laser weapons, but both of those are in the cards. But we did that, and we did a lot of things. We talked about a Chinese atomic bomb test. Probably my favorite thing that we did in that 20-year period is Ingo Swann described on Tuesday a atomic bomb test that was going to be done by the Chinese on Thursday. So 3 days in advance, he psychically described what he presented as a pyrotechnic display, huge streamers, bombs bursting in air, but no explosion. And it turned out to be a failed uranium bomb, which does look just like a pyrotechnic display. And Ingo described that in pristine detail 2 days before it occurred.
Well, it seems to me, Russell, that the program worked. Why did they disband it, or did they?
Well, we were kept in business for 25 years, so that's probably in my. I worked for the government my whole career. I worked 40 years for doing different things for the government, and a 25-year program doing more or less the same thing is probably a record breaker.
Sure.
As we sat in our little office building in Palo Alto, describing Chinese weapons tests, American hostages in Iran, lost airplanes in Africa, all kinds of kidnap scenarios. So we were just a branch of the CIA that supported ourselves. And that went on for 25 years. Then in 1995, the CIA in its wisdom decided that we no longer had any serious enemies. So they ended the program. And at that time, I also got it declassified so I could have this conversation without going to jail.
Yeah.
So in 95, the program was declassified.
Russell, I'm going to ask you this because of two reasons. One, I respect the heck out of you. And two, I'm not sure anybody's ever been able to get this kind of information out from anybody. But do you believe or did your group ever test the possibility of crashed UFOs or anything like that that the CIA requested?
The CIA never asked us about crashed UFOs. Both Ingo Swann and Pat Price had descriptions of crashed UFOs that they offered us. And I had an interesting experience left to my own with all the UFO stories of Price and Swann. I went for a psychic UFO adventure by myself that I've never talked about, where I went looking for a UFO in my evening meditation and found such a craft and saw a bunch of what looked like bodies under hair dryers, and then felt very frightened. I felt it was very dangerous, and I left. This is all my mental experience. And I described this to Pat Price the next day. It was Price, a prodigious, experienced psychic. And he said, "Oh, my God, you're lucky you got out of there. It's full of so-called theta traps, and you were in the body storage area. You're lucky they let you out." So that's what I'm describing is my sort of inner space, is a story I never told before. I don't know what it means, but it resonated with Price, who was no fool. I mean, he was a Los Angeles City policeman his whole life. So I got confirmation from Price that there was something like that.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Russell, and in some incredible other areas of your work with ESP Research. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in just a moment with Russell Targ. We're talking about his life story. Do you see what I see?